Anya is not with us. All right. Welcome, everyone, to our November 2021 Pulmonary Journal Club. Thanks for joining us. Hopefully, this recording will work. There were, unfortunately, a lot of articles this month, so there's a lot to go through on your own because we certainly won't have time to go over everything that was published in October. I thought I would start with this article on a disease I had never heard of, GATA2 deficiency, because there are a number of pulmonary abnormalities and it might be something for us to add to our differential. So this is an autosomal dominant or sporadic disease. It's often recognized by the presence of severe or recurrent infections, lymphedema, other things that we generally wouldn't maybe pay attention to, monocytopenia, dendritic cells, cytopenias, myelodysplastic syndrome, and AML, but there are some things in that occur in the lung as well. It's a zinc finger transcription factor essential for the differentiation of endothelial cells and immature hematopoietic cells, hence the problem with the cytopenias and the lymphedema. It also is involved in promoting phagocytosis by alveolar macrophages. And the current study describes pulmonary manifestations of G2D, as I'm going to call it, in a large cohort followed at the NIH. So they looked at medical records from 95 probands, as well as 29 additional patients who weren't really patients at the time. They were identified through screening of the proband families. And they all had a mutation proven G2D identified between 1992 and 2020. They're actually quite a broad age range here, 8 to 86. Male-female ratio approximately 3 to 1. And one of the most common modes of presentation was disseminated or pulmonary MAC infections occurring in late childhood or adulthood. Others had recurrent bronchitis or multiple pneumonias, and a few had fungal infections. The lung pathology was comprised of 38 biopsies from the probands, although they didn't really state whether these were transbronchs, cryos, needles, or VATS biopsies. They also had 5 probands in whom they had pathology or an autopsy. I thought the interesting thing was that a significant number of these had alveolar proteinosis, and only one of them had anti-GM-CSF antibodies. And eight of these were based on biopsies, so presumably the other 3 were based on BAL samples, although some of that wasn't quite clear in the paper. BAL showed lymphocytosis, monocytosis, and neutrophilic predominance as seen there. So, you know, it doesn't sound like there's a definite trend on BAL. Biopsies, and these weren't terribly well described, but the biopsies showed chronic lymphohistiocytic inflammation with scattered EOs and no granulomas. They demonstrated an abundance of alveolar macrophages, despite the absence of peripheral blood monocytes. And again, I would like them to have gone into sort of a differential on whether these looked like DIP, but they didn't have any details along those lines. Radiology in the absence of active infections included apical predominant reticulation, central vascular prominence, periseptal emphysema, which was sometimes extensive. Perhaps consistent with these patients having immunodeficiency, bronchiectasis was identified in 10% of the probands. I won't go into the treatment and the response. It's quite detailed in the manuscript if you're interested in that part of the disease. So several mechanisms may be at work in causing the lung pathology in these patients, including abnormal alveolar macrophages, impaired pulmonary lymphatic circulation, impaired phagocytosis, and possibly a lack of new monocytes repopulating the pulmonary compartment because there's not a lot of monocytes presumably being produced in the bone marrow. So Perhaps this is a disease to suggest, another disease to suggest in the setting of alveolar proteinosis and in the setting of atypical mycobacterial infections that don't fit with sort of the usual categories of, you know, HIV, upper lobe predominant COPD patients, hot tub, you know, lung kinds of patients, and then the patients with bronchiectasis and atypical mycobacterial infection. So any questions or comments?
Did any of the cases that have biopsies, were they the atypical mycobacterial infection? In other words, did they lack granulomas, or just were those cases not biopsied?
I think those patients weren't biopsied, Tom. I was a little frustrated by the lack of pathology description. So I think that those were the ones who weren't biopsied, but I would have to look at the actual paper, but I don't think so. I mean, mostly they describe this, you know, lymphohistiocytic inflammation. And I think that, you know, the point was there weren't granulomas, but I don't know that that's a great thinking about, you know, atypical mycobacterial infection in this setting. Let me just pull out the paper here a minute. Non-tuberculous mycobacteria in 42. I think those were probably the non ones, but I can't say for sure. Pathology. So here's the pathology section, and there's the images they show, which are obviously non-granulomatous. So I, you know, like I said, I think, but I don't know that it's all that clear in the paper.
Do they specify the different species of mycobacteria? Just for curiosity.
I think they do. Common, so MAC or Kansasii.
Okay.
So, all right. Any other questions, comments?
Thank you, Henry. That's a useful paper to know about. Appreciate it.
So I was sort of interested in this next paper. We had a patient here of a woman who worked at Intel. There's a local Intel plant here. And Karen Swanson, who's the pulmonologist who was seeing her, was convinced that her sarcoidosis, which was classic under the microscope, we had a VATS biopsy on her, was due to her silica exposure. She worked in the clean room at the Intel plant. And so this article tries to summarize, it's a review of the last 10 to 20 years of epidemiologic studies and case reports that seem to show a causal association between occupational exposure to specific agents and sarcoidosis. So, you know, it's a little bit weak on the statistical side of things. So it's really a literature review with a focus on exposures for which, as they say, there's greater consistency and, quote, strength of association. So maybe take that for what it's worth. Table one, I've summarized the associations, and they think that the most compelling associations are for silica and silicates. All of the stuff that's present in the dust related to the World Trade Center collapse and metals. So you can see there's a wide variety of occupations or industries in which folks are exposed to silica, silicates, World Trade Center dust, and then metals, including, you know, the metal industry, mining, transportation, and then tunnel construction. The data for silica and silicates mostly comes from case reports and case-controlled epidemiologic studies. The articles list a number of those studies. I haven't reiterated them here. I thought the World Trade Center stuff was fascinating. I'm sure we've all seen occasional biopsies from these patients. The major components of all of that dust included limestone, gypsum, bastnaesite, and crystalline silica. They are also relatively high concentrations of manganese, aluminum, barium, titanium from building construction materials and paint. paint contains a lot of titanium. There are also smaller amounts of chromium, lead, zinc, and other organic compounds. A few of the studies for this, I will quote, there's one by Kaplan Shaw, which examined the lung tissue from World Trade Center collapse residents nearby and local workers who had abnormal imaging and PFT. So they actually had a reason to have a lung biopsy. And they analyzed 5 of 12, so not a large series, but they had aluminum silicates, titanium, and talc. And silica was found in 4 out of 5, and steel, which I wouldn't know steel was iron, I guess chromium and nickel in 3 of them. A couple of other studies have shown biopsy-confirmed sarcoid-like granulomatous lung disease in firefighters compared to a cohort looked at 15 years prior. And I think, you know, I was familiar with some of that information, but not all of the analysis. And then the last was this metal dust exposure. And, you know, we're all familiar with the beryllium test, the beryllium lymphocyte stimulation test. And they have been using a similar sort of test, which they're calling the metal test, lymphocyte stimulation test. So a lot of the data for the metal dust association with sarcoid comes from this sort of analysis where they're using this lymphocyte stimulation test with metals other than beryllium. So titanium, nickel, chromium, mercury, and palladium. And you can all take out your atomic charts to figure out where they all fit in the atomic, their numbering in the atomic chart. So these authors, based on these data, propose that when sarcoidosis is suspected, a detailed occupational and environmental history should be obtained, and that sarcoidosis should no longer be considered idiopathic until this has been done. And they also suggest that maybe we ought to be using these lymphocyte proliferation tests as diagnostic tools over a broader range of metals in larger studies for validation. So I guess pay attention to the history in sarcoid cases, it might be relevant. And they didn't really talk about whether avoidance of the offending agent would affect the course of sarcoid, for example. But I thought it might be kind of nice to know. You know, most patients get treated with steroids or nothing if they're not very symptomatic. Questions, comments?
That sounds like a whole lot of legal cases waiting to happen.
Yeah,
it does, with the same burden in terms of attribution, right? I mean, exactly. It's not a surprise that you find dust in the lungs of people who were at the site of the World Trade Center collapse, but that doesn't really prove cause and effect until you can process similar specimens from patients who don't have lung disease with similar exposures. And of course, that wouldn't make any sense ethically. And to me, the most compelling evidence for the World Trade Center collapse has not been those sorts of tissue studies, because I don't know what they mean. But the kind of statistical analysis that looks at differences in incidence rates, and those seem to me a little more compelling. But the problem with all of this is kind of getting to what caused what, and does correlation mean attribution? And as Tom says, that just means a whole lot of legal cases.
Yes, well, folks are waiting for that.
I did actually, Henry, look at one of those papers, and the odds ratio was like 1.2 or something, so that it was a slight increase. And if you think about how sarcoid is diagnosed, all of us have seen biopsies in patients who have had a quote diagnosis of sarcoid and it was something else.
Yes.
So in addition to the epidemiologic data, we need to know how they made the diagnosis of sarcoid in those cases. Was it just by x-ray or biopsy? And these are also a population of patients that are likely to get screened by CT scans. So how many of these are asymptomatic patients that are picked up by screening?
And that's yeah. I think, a key point. That's been my concern. They show an increased incidence in survivors of the WTC collapse, but they've been heavily screened. And so it's, I don't know, it's just, I'm a skeptic by nature, and I don't think this is proven by any means.
Yeah, you know, it's, I thought it was worth talking about, but your points are well taken. All right. So maybe don't pay attention to the history and sarcoidosis. It might not be relevant.
No, it's frequently asked. It's really important.
All right. The next three papers I've got here, one is an editorial, which I put first, mostly to pull this table out, because the other two papers have to do with grading of lung cancer. And then because I was also a skeptic about the conclusions of at least one of these studies, I sent it to one of our epidemiologists, Ping Yang, who has a strong interest in lung cancer. And I've sort of cut and pasted her comments from her email after these articles. So the next couple of studies look at comparisons of the three sort of grading schemes which have been proposed for adenocarcinoma. So the new IASLC one, which occurs and is printed in the WHO, the one by Sika et al, in which two patterns are predominant, and then a somewhat simpler architectural grading scheme. Lipidic predominant is low grade, and you know, acinar or papillary predominant intermediate, and then solid cubriform, micropapillary are high grade. So let me jump down to these papers, but I just wanted to remind everybody what those studies or what the grading schemes were. So in this first article, and both of these are from Asia, and both purport that they wanted to test the grading schemes in an Asian population. So this first one is from China. And in addition to looking at the IASLC classification, they correlated the grading system with common driver mutations. They had 950 patients with invasive adenocarcinoma, retrospectively analyzed, and then classified according to the proposed IASLC grading system. They also correlated with genetic data, as I mentioned, response to chemotherapy, adjuvant chemotherapy, and patient outcomes. These studies included AIS, minimally invasive, and invasive mucinous adenocarcinomas. So this first study by Deng also compared it to the architectural pattern-based groups. And they showed that compared to that group, the IASLC grading system carried improved survival discrimination. The area under the curve for recurrence-free survival was 0.768 for recurrence-free survival and 0.775 for overall survival. The area under the curve wasn't further improved when lymphatic invasion was identified, and the Kappa score was higher for the IASLC grading system than for the conventional architecturally based groups, 0.63 versus 0.58. Most of the discrepant cases were attributed to observed differences in the proportion of the high-grade patterns, particularly those close to the threshold of 20%, which I suppose is not all that surprising. EGFR mutations were correlated with moderately differentiated tumors in KRAS, and ALK fusions were more prevalent in the high-grade tumors. When incorporating EGFR mutation status into the grading system, they showed excellent survival discrimination, in particular patients with higher stage disease who were treated with adjuvant chemotherapy in whom there was an improved prognosis. So their conclusion was the IASLC system is a good discriminator for patient prognosis and should be part of the pathologic/genetic subtyping to improve prognostication. It may also support patient stratification for chemotherapy. So why don't we hold on that? I'll go to the next paper, and then I want to show you Ping's analysis as well, because I think it sort of fit with my own thoughts about these two papers. So this study looked at all three of those grading systems. And again, they were particularly interested in looking at Asian patients. So AIS and MIA and mucinous lesions were also excluded for this study. They had over 1,000 patients, and they looked at the concordant index and the ROC curves. And there's a lot of statistics in this paper. Feel free to look at them all. But I've tried to summarize below the performance of each grading system for disease-free survival and overall survival using, you know, the area under the curve and the receiver operated characteristics and the C index at 5 years. Again, the statistics are quite elaborate and beyond me. They also generated inter-observer agreement using 100 randomly selected cases. And for the IASLC grading system, it was 0.94 between two pathologists. So, you know, here's the numbers, and they conclude that the IASLC is acceptable as a prognostic indicator for both recurrence and cause of death, although the SICA et al. System gives almost identical results. And they acknowledge that the limitations of the study are that they didn't include invasive mucinous or minimally invasive carcinomas. You know, as I look at these numbers, I didn't think that the ARCH system, the architectural system, was all that far away. I mean, you know, if we look here, 0.77, 0.763, and 0.786, you know, I don't know that those are clinically meaningful. And here was Ping's comments straight. So I sent her just this paper, not the one with the EGFR, the Deng paper, but the second one. She says, I concur with your conclusions. The difference between these two systems doesn't appear to be clinically meaningful. More meaningful is the superiority of the SICA system in stage one patients, particularly for disease-free survival, which could be more clinically relevant considering adjuvant appropriate therapy. Recognizing the purpose of this work was to compare the three grading systems. The two major caveats are the baseline models. And again, here's where, you know, take it for what it's worth because I don't quite follow the statistics, but the baseline models in table two seem not built fully or properly, which only include age, includes stage, other potential prognostic factors listed in table one were not used with no reasons provided. So, you know, I just don't know what to make out of these two papers. I'm not sure that they show the superiority of the IASLC grading system. I do think that the article here, the editorial, which is by Andrew Nicholson, Andre Morera, and Mari, for, you know, say that, you know, until our clinical colleagues actually use GRADE, it's hard to get too excited about GRADE as a way of stratifying patients for treatment. It's a little bit dancing on the head of a pin. I mean, I don't quite say it that way, but clearly additional work needs to be done. And, you know, until our clinicians use, I mean, I've never had anybody ask me what the grade is, right? And, you know, frequently we change the grades on prostate cancers and other things, but kind of so far, nobody seems to care about, at least in our practice or the consultation practice. So anyway, all of this is open for vigorous discussion.
Yeah, I thought we got away from prognostic markers years ago and we were into predictive markers.
Yeah, well, they're it's certainly used prognostically in breast and prostate, which is, you know, what the editorial highlights.
I think the only area where this might become more relevant going forward, but I agree 100% with you, Henry. I've never been asked in this practice about grade. When I've asked our senior thoracic oncologist about that, he said, you know, the only time it might matter to us is in small biopsies from patients who might be increasingly considered candidates for less than lobectomy. And there it's useful to know that it's a lipidic predominant low-grade cancer. And he wouldn't much care how you said that and any of these systems, you know, the narrative would be the same. So I don't, yeah, I mean, to your point, the circumstances in which it might be useful are identifying patients for adjuvant therapy and identifying patients for whom surgical options might be more broad. At least that's the way it seems to me. I'd be interested, Kelly's heavily involved in these things and kind of translating them into CAP checklists. What are your what are you thinking about this, Kelly?
She's on, but muted, and she's on her phone. Maybe she had to step away.
Yep.
Yeah, anybody else have comments?
I mean, I just didn't think that, I mean, what struck me about both of these papers was it seemed to me they were stretching the truth a bit to support the ISLC grading system. Because the differences here, I don't think can really be clinically meaningful between these three.
Yeah, the only thing that's less meaningful, it seems to me, is grading mesotheliomas. And for sure, no one's asked us about that.
Fair enough. All right. Nobody has any comments.
One more comment. I mean, the diagnoses that we give these days actually import prognosis. If we say invasive mucinous, that's going to imply a whole certain thing. And as Jeff said, if we say lipidic predominant non-mucinous, that's a small nodule, we know that's good prognosis. So there is a fair bit of prognosis carried in the diagnoses that are currently made.
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, I think grading it probably with any of those grading systems, I mean, I think part of it is to try to be consistent, right? So, you know, if your group is using one or the other, it's probably good to all be using the same grading system. Kelly, you're back. We were wondering if you had listened to the discussion on grading in these papers. We'd be interested in your thoughts. Oh. Her face showed back up. Nope.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes. No. We're losing you, Kelly. All right, I'll move on. It's too bad Anya is not here today, but there's a paper that might be useful. They were looking at, so this is expression markers for BCL2. This should be Ecadherin, beta-catenin, PAX8, MIB1, and I think this is BCL2. I don't know why, or I don't know what EMB was. That's a typo that I missed, I guess. So,
is it EMA?
Oh, it is EMA. Yeah, sorry, it is EMA, not EMB. Thank you. So this is looking at expression patterns in the various patterns of thymoma, as well as the B3s, the ones that used to be called well-differentiated carcinomas. And these are from the Beth Israel. I didn't know, maybe Tom, you know, is this Saul Schuster's son?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, I figured that was probably the case. So
David.
David, yeah, like father, like son. So that's pretty cool. They looked at the expression of these various markers across a large number of thymomas. And, you know, sometimes we struggle with whether it's a B3 or not. And so, you know, here I think it shows that using a MIB might help you out, particularly if you have a combined tumor, you know, where some of it looks lower or, you know, looks like a different type. And then you're concerned about there being a B3 component. So, you know, a significant increase in MIB, you know, it's probably less important to separate A and AB from the Bs, but at least in this study, EMA and BCL2 seem to sort of stand out as potentials for making that separation. Let's see.
How many cases there, Henry?
Quite a few.
130.
Yeah. Not as many as you might expect, I guess, you know, from Saul's large experience. The next paper, I think, is probably minutia for most of us, although I thought as a paper, it was just not a very good paper. So micronodular thymic carcinoma with lymphoid hyperplasia. This is out of a large German group. And, you know, here's a table just summarizing their results. And it's like, well, why? I mean, I summarize this, right, to sort of pull it out to say, how does this get past a reviewer, right? You know, they have 26 cases of micronodular thymoma to compare it to the carcinomas, in which they only had 6, and they don't give the results for all these other studies. So anyway, my conclusion was, whenever you get an unusual thymoma, share it with Dr. Rode, who's been enormously helpful. There was a nice study, although not a whole lot of cases, of primary lung carcinoma in children and adolescents. I was kind of surprised that they had none of these had adenocarcinomas with pre-existing cystic lung lesions. Although I noticed, I think in CHEST or some journal I was just looking at, maybe AJSP, there appears to be a recent series on that. So maybe we'll hear about that next month. There's a bunch of stuff related to microRNAs, using the IDILA IGFR mutation test, which is sort of the one shot deal where you stick the tumor in and you get an answer, but it's only for EGFR. If you're interested in that, we are learning more about small cell carcinoma, and this paper looked at one of the small cell carcinoma variants. As you recall, there's sort of 4 molecular variants of small cell, and they looked at YAP1 protein expression in small cell. They had quite a large number. They said there were almost 300 patients who had surgery. They didn't die. They didn't say what that surgery was, but they combined small cell with small cell carcinoma, and had a fairly rigorous H score for intensity and distribution. They also did a number of other stains as well. YAP expression, which is a nuclear stain, was significantly higher in the combined small cells than in the pure small cells. And they thought that, according to their results, if you had YAP1 expression, it was an unfavorable predictor for overall survival in the combined group. So, I don't know if these were all surgically resected or if they had, biopsies. Again, they don't really say. It would also be interesting to know how well this stain works on smaller samples, which is what most of us get when we're diagnosing small cell carcinoma.
I suspect they meant surgery as opposed to cytology.
Perhaps. But,
because that's a huge number.
Yeah, but a needle isn't surgery to me, right? So I don't know. Not quite clear. I'll skip over that paper. There's some more info, and I guess I have to start paying attention to this now because, woohoo, we're going to be doing PD-L1 in Arizona. So the Rochester folks, you won't have to look at our PD-L1s starting sometime next year, for which I'm sure you're grateful. Although we won't take a lot off your plate because we don't get that many of these, but we are going to be doing PD-L1. So it did look at ethanol fixed EBIS samples versus non-ethanol fixed. And ethanol fixation prior to formalin fixation seems to result in a large number of false negative PD-L1 immunostains. So I don't know if anybody else on the line has experience with that. And I think we'll probably have to pay attention to how our cytology samples here are fixed. And I don't currently know that. Jen or anybody from Rochester, do you, I mean, you know, in the consult practice and all of the stuff that you look at from the outside, I'm sure you don't know how any of that stuff has been fixed.
Yeah, so I think we have a disclaimer on all of our reports that has a comment about decalcification of specimens and about fixation for cytology specimens, and basically says that you know it hasn't been validated on those types of specimens. So people can order it and we'll give them a result, but there's a caveat that's listed, I think, on every one of our reports, I'm not mistaken.
We do the same, although our laboratory has validated on our internal cell blocks. And I'm not 100% sure what their fixative is. I think it may be ethanol, but they did validate 22C3 on our cell blocks. But we'll read them from the outside with the same disclaimers.
Okay, good to know. Thanks. There's another study on PD-L1 and correlating that with tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. I'll let you take a look at that. There was a large...
Could I ask Jeff a quick question about the cell blocks?
Because you can.
We do cytolite fixation, which is some kind of alcohol fixation here. And then we post-fix our cell blocks in formalin. Do you guys do that? And do you know how long
I have no idea.
Okay. Because I think how long it's fixed in formalin is very important as well. And we're trying to standardize that.
Yeah, I was not personally involved in any of that validation, so I just don't know, Margaret.
Do you know if I could get that info from you guys?
I'm sure you could.
Thank you.
Yeah, here, you know, that's what they did in this study was they had ethanol fixed and then they stuck it in formalin. So I don't know what we do here either, but I'll probably delve into that a little more. Let's just skip that. Let's see what else I have here. Oh, there's more on STAS if anybody wants to read it. There's volleys back and forth about STAS, as you might imagine. There's a surgical study looking at segmentectomy versus wedge and a lot of commentary. And I think, you know, it's going to be a while before before that gets settled, perhaps in the surgical world. I think one other study we talked about, the SS18-SSX immunohistochemical stain for synovial sarcoma. Has anybody brought that antibody up?
We have, and it's proven very useful.
We have two, Henry.
I believe, yeah.
We have two in Arizona?
We have it in Rochester.
No, we have it in Rochester. It's really useful.
Okay, all right. I haven't had any lately, so... I think an interesting conclusion from this study was that there were three patients in whom the immunostain was negative and the FISH was negative, and they concluded that maybe those weren't actually synovial sarcomas because it's sort of become definitional, I guess. So I don't know, Brandon, if you have any thoughts on that or Jen.
Yeah, I don't know what Jen would say. That sure raises the possibility of something else in my mind.
Yeah, I guess how were that? What were their inclusion criteria for synovial sarcoma? I mean, I think it's at this point essentially a genetic diagnosis, nearly. Even though the morphology is usually very classical, it can be mistaken for something like MPNST or I guess a fibrosarcoma in the superficial soft tissue. So.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Oh, this India's second wave of coronavirus and the black fungus. I don't know why it has to be called black fungus and not just mucor, but it's mucor, and it occurs in, it's been reported to be associated with COVID-19 in a significant number of patients in India, whereas previously it was quite rare. There's a large radiology study looking at CT patterns in vapors. We continue to see vaping. Brandon had two cases last week. So we continue to see these cases and occasional ones in whom the differential, of course, is this COVID related or could this be their vaping? So we at least continue to see vaping cases. There's some more stuff on MERS. And MERS and COVID, of course. There's a summary on liquid biopsies for advanced non-small cell carcinoma. And this last study here is a nice review on the current state of pulmonary neuroendocrine tumors. And there's the questions that it sort of seeks to answer. What are the preferred outcome parameters? Does the WHO classification combined with T67 and molecular markers improve prognostication for low-grade low-grade neuroendocrine tumors? What's the value of an atypical versus typical diagnosis on a biopsy specimen in local versus metastatic disease? And then what's the relevance of separating large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma from small cell? And then the value of those markers, which are related to the small cell subtypes. And then are additional diagnostic criteria required to accurately separate large cell from non-small cell lung biopsies? I actually had that on my list to read yesterday, just because to sort of read it in detail, which I did not do, but something I still hope to do. But there it is, in case you want to read it over your, you know, Christmas weekend coming up. All right, I think that's it.
Henry, I had some connectivity issues regarding when you were talking about the lung cancer grading, and I did not participate in the IASLC grading schema creation. But my major beef about it is that they still include complex fused glands as ASNR, which makes accurate grading unnecessarily difficult, I feel, rather than making another pattern. They lumped it in there, but yet it should be included in high grade. That's my only editorial comment.
Okay, all right. Well, do you have strong feelings about whether one of those is better than the others? Because I, at least in these studies, it didn't seem all that different.
Yeah, I read those studies with interest myself and thought it was interesting that they included both those studies that were getting at answering the same question in slightly different ways. It seemed like kind of a draw.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. And the only time that I have ever gotten asked specifically about grading is when one of the registrars or one of the study coordinators has to fill it in a blank in a patient profile thing, quite frankly.
Right. When somebody has failed to put a number or something on it, you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Thanks, Henry. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, Henry.